Good evening. Let me begin with a declaration, make it clear that the shir tonight, the Chazar shir, as well as the review questions, are not meant to be comprehensive. There may and can and will be things that we don't cover. What's the purpose? I'm not sure, but we'll do a little Chazar together. As I said before, you really don't have to memorize anything for this Bechina. Koros will be on the test itself. Moreover, you'll have a choice of questions. So if there's something, you know, that tzaddok that you can't understand, I can't understand, so you don't have to worry too much about it. We'll try our best. So let's start. We'll go in order from beginning. So the first topic we did was the Rambam and Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, and then we'll go through some of the sample questions. So in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph, the Rambam begins Yisoda Yisoda Samuda Chachma Leida Sheyesh Matzui Rishon. We talked about how the mitzvah of Emunah is Yediya. It's not just enough to have, at least L'chatchila, to have Emunah based on the Mesorah, but it has to be Yediya. And what is this Yediya? That Hashem is the first cause. V'humanti kol ha-nimtza, v'chol ha-nimtza mishamayim v'aretz, mash b'neim lo nimtza'o, ela me'amitas himatz'o. So we talked about how the Rambam does not explicitly state here that God created the world. And in fact, in the Mor Nevuchim, when he offers proofs for the existence of God, he writes explicitly that the proofs that he's giving are based on the assumption which Aristotle presumes that matter is eternal, meaning, say, God didn't create the universe. Now, we have a number of questions to ask on this. Question number one is, doesn't this contradict what the Rambam says in one of the Yesodos HaEmunah, one of the Yud Gimel Ikar HaEmunah, is explicitly that God created the world? How can he base his proof on God upon something that he clearly thinks is false? Because he clearly thinks that God created the world. After all, it's one of the Yud Gimel Ikar HaEmunah. So the answer to this is stated explicitly in the Rambam himself. He writes that the reason why he is not assuming the creation of the world is because that is something which cannot be proven definitively. The Rambam thinks that is the more compelling option. The two options, he actually has four options over there: Plato, Aristotle, Moshe, and a certain groups of Islamic philosophers. But Aristotle being the eternity of matter, what he calls the opinion of Moshe, which is that God created the world. Plato's position is that God made the world out of something else, very similar to Aristotle. And the fourth option, which he also thinks is wrong, is that the world is constantly being recreated. This is an idea that we didn't get into, something similar to Mechadish Betuva B'chol Yom Tamid is understood, let's say, by the Nefesh HaChayim. Be that as it may, the Rambam thinks that you can't prove definitively, meaning to say with logic, that God created the world, but is certainly the more compelling option. Not only that, but the entire belief in Torah rests on that principle. In other words, the Rambam is absolutely clear. If you deny creation of the world, you're denying all of Torah. Not, as the Rambam says, because this can be proven from the text of the Torah. The text of the Torah does not definitively prove that God created the world, because I could reinterpret the text in an allegorical fashion, in which would correspond to Aristotle's theory that matter is eternal, but because the Torah believes in Nisim, and the Torah believes in Hashgacha, and interaction, and the like, and all of that depends upon God having created the world. So the Rambam absolutely, positively believed that God created the world. So if so, why aren't his proofs for God based on that assumption? The answer is that if he were to assume that God created the world and his proofs for God, then obviously there would be no point in proving God. Because once you assume that God created the world, then you no longer need to prove God's existence. So therefore, in his proofs for God's existence, he says lishitaschem, meaning to say, even according to you, the students of Aristotle, that presume the eternity of matter, I can still prove the existence of God in a definitive way. And thus he offers four proofs. So he doesn't say this because he believes matter is eternal. He absolutely does not. He believes that the whole Torah rests on the assumption that God created the world. Rather, for his proofs to be solid proofs, he presumes the assumption of those he's arguing with, namely that matter is eternal, and still believes he could prove God's existence. The Rambam in Halacha Dalid continues, Hu shanavi omer v'ashem elokim emes. Hu levado emes v'ein l'acher emes kamitasa. What does this mean, that God alone is true, there is no other truth like God's truth? What he means here is that God's existence is a necessary truth, meaning to say it couldn't be otherwise, it's inconceivable otherwise, or in all possible worlds, it would be the case that God's existence is true, God's existence is necessary. This is different than all other truths. All other truths are accidental. They could have been this way, it could have been otherwise. This chair might exist, but it could have not existed. It happens to exist, it's accidental. It's not necessary. Whereas when it comes to the existence of God is necessary, meaning to say it's inconceivable otherwise. And therefore the truth is like no other truth. The Rambam continues that it's not just the case that God exists, but Hamatsu Yazehu Elokei Olam Adon Kol Haaretz, God interacts with the world, and knowledge of this is implied by the first of the Ten Commandments, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Anochi Hashem is God's existence, Elokecha, that I'm God that relates to the world. And that is the first two major themes. Then he continues that the Achdus of Hashem, which can be derived from the Pasuk, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, is the third thing that he tries to prove. What do we mean when we say God is one? We mean, first of all, that he's not two or three or four. There's one God. There's not two gods. There's not a God of good and a God of evil, but simply one God. Moreover, that he's simple in the sense that he's not comprised of many parts. Unlike physical things, which are one but can then be broken apart further into their parts, God's oneness is one in the simplest. He cannot be broken down further. This means that, among other things, we can't attribute certain qualities to him, because that would imply he's divisible. There's God and his kindness, or his knowledge, or the like. Rather, they are essential, and that's why, if we were to be honest, we could only refer to God in terms of negative attributes, not positive attributes. We do practically refer to God in terms of positive attributes in two senses. First of all, practically it's necessary, because if we're to relate to God or understand God, we need to be able to describe him. And second of all, when we say that God is, let's say, Rachum, what we mean to say is that God interacts with us, or interacts with the world, or even more specifically, we perceive God's interaction with the world in such a way that parallels the way in which we perceive kindness or the like. Yes?
One question, Rabbi. If you want to go back to, he's saying, let's assume that the universe is eternal, they want to prove God's existence. So would that not in itself prove that the universe is not eternal? Because how can you?
No. It's theoretically possible for God to exist and for the universe to be eternal, and they're two eternal things. The Rambam thinks that's not true, but he's trying to prove that even if you assume that the universe is eternal, or that matter is eternal, then God's existence is necessary. Okay. Let's... another point, which is in page 2 of the New Source books. The Rambam, as we said, believes that Anochi is a mitzvah in the Torah, unlike the Ramban in Sefer HaMitzvos, though not like the Ramban in his Pershah HaTorah. The Rambam proves this in Sefer HaMitzvos from the Gemara in Makos, Daf Chav Dalet, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, which says that Moshe gave us Gematria Torah, 611 mitzvos, but the 612th and 13th, as it were coming from God. It was Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, but God commanded us the first two. The Meshech Chachma, the Ramban asks a question on this. One question he asks is, how could there be a mitzvah to believe? After all, if I believe, I believe, and if I don't believe, then I don't believe. What's the point of a mitzvah? To that, the Rambam might answer that the mitzvah is to try to prove God's existence, as we said, Leida, and part of the mitzvah of Emunah is an attempt to prove, as in fact the Rambam does do himself. Another question that the Ramban raises is that the Rambam is inconsistent in his understanding of the Gemara in Makos, because in the first two Dibros, Anochi and Lo Yiyah, there are actually five mitzvos, because in Lo Yiyah there's four Azharos. There's Lo Sasa Lecha Pesel, Lo Sishtachav Elohem, Lo Sa'avdeim, and therefore, which one is it? If you're going to say that the first two Dibros were said by God, so then that would mean not that there are 611 mitzvos by Moshe and two by God, but there are 600, and there are four mitzvos by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and 609 by God. By the opposite. Four mitzvos by God and 609 by Moshe.
So
the Meshech Chachma...
Those are separate mitzvos in the category of 613?
Yes. If you look at the Rambam's Minyan HaMitzvos. The Meshech Chachma brilliantly answers this question by pointing us to another famous statement by the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim in Chelek Beis Perek Lamed Gimel, where the Rambam writes that Yisbar Eli shebemamad Har Sinai lo haya hamagia lemoshe magia lechol Yisrael aval adibor lemoshe levado. It's not the like the Pashup shot that all of Klal Yisrael heard the first two Dibros. Rather, what it means is that all of Klal Yisrael, only Moshe heard the actual voice of God, actual words of God. That's because Klal Yisrael were not prepared for prophecy, and human beings that haven't reached the appropriate madrega can't possibly receive prophecy. Rather, Klal Yisrael heard sounds, but only Moshe heard words, as he puts it. V'amar kol dvarim atem shomim, v'lo amar dvarim atem shomim. The pasuk says kol dvarim. What is kol dvarim? Meant you heard a voice. V'hu amram anochi v'lo yiyah mipi agvur. Then the Rambam says a beautiful pshat. He says, what does it mean then, anochi and lo yiyah mipi agvura? After all, Klal Yisrael just heard a kol. They didn't hear actual words. So how could anochi and lo yiyah be mipi agvura? What's pshat in the Gemara in Makos? And the Rambam answers that the Gemara in Makos means that the first two Dibros were heard by all of Klal Yisrael, meaning to say they were known by all of Klal Yisrael in the same way or in an equal way that Moshe knew them. Why? Because God's existence, the basis of the first two Dibros, meaning that God exists and that there aren't other gods or other powers, is something that could be proven through a mofes, through a proof, through a philosophical proof. It could be something that's definitively proven. If I could prove something through logic, if I could prove it definitively, then I know it with certainty. I don't know it based on something that somebody told me, but I know it myself. Meaning to say, somebody that knows of God's existence through a philosophical proof is equivalent to someone who actually heard prophetically, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. And therefore, the knowledge of Klal Yisrael was equivalent to the knowledge of Moshe, and hence, there's no my love Moshe over Klal Yisrael. And that's what it meant when it said Anochi and Lo Yiyah were heard mipi agvur, meaning to say there's no difference between Klal Yisrael and Moshe. If that's the case, the Meshech Chachma says the Ramban's kasha of why isn't this four Azharos is not a kasha. It doesn't mean that the first two mitzvos, but it meant the first two Dibros, because those two Dibros could be understood through mofes, through proof. Then we raised in class a very interesting kasha on this principle from the Mor Nevuchim, which is, it seems to be soser what the Rambam says is a important principle in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah Perek Ches. In Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah Perek Ches, the Rambam writes that Uvameh aminu bo. Why do Klal Yisrael believe in Torah Moshe? It's not because of the Nisim. After all, someone who bases their belief upon Nisim always has a tinge of doubt. Rather, She'enein b'mamad har Sinai, She'enein ra'u v'lo zar, v'oznenu sham'u v'lo acher, ha'esh v'hakolos v'alapidim, v'hu nigash el ha'rafel v'akol medaberi lav, v'anu shomim, Moshe Moshe, lech emor lahem, kach v'kach. And that's what it means, panim b'panim. Now, the question is like this. The Rambam says, why do we believe in Taras Moshe? Because we ourselves heard it. It's not like Nisim. Nisim, maybe it was just good magic. But here, we ourselves heard it. And that is the basis of Nevuas Moshe. But one second, that seems to contradict what he says in Mar Nevuchim. Mar Nevuchim says we didn't hear any words. We just heard Kol Dvarim. So actually, in Shir I said an answer to that question. However, I subsequently heard, I think, a better answer to that question. And in the name of Rabbi Treibitz. And he answered a very good chap, but I think he's right. The Gemara in Bava Basra, Tesvav Amud Aleph, says, it talks about how Moshe Rabbeinu heard the Torah. It's the famous Gemara that talked about the last 8 psukim of the Torah. So, at least according to some Gersos in the Gemara, and he argued this is the Rambam's Gers in the Gemara, it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer, Umoshe Omer V'Kosev. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would say the Torah to Moshe, and Moshe Rabbeinu would say it and write it. Now, what is the need for saying it and writing it? I mean, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe would repeat it. And that might be the pshat here as well. All of Klal Yisrael heard kolos. They heard a voice. Now, look at the lashon of the Rambam. It's actually very meduyak. The Rambam writes, V'huni gash el harafel, Moshe went to the harafel, v'akol midaberi lav, and the voice spoke to him, v'anu shomim, and we heard, Moshe lech emor lahem kach v'kach. Now, it doesn't say, V'akol medaberi lav, Moshe, Moshe, lech emor lahem kach v'kach, or v'akol medaberi lav, anochi Hashem elokach, or the like. What does it say? We heard the call, and then we heard Moshe say, Moshe, Moshe, lech emor lahem kach v'kach, because Moshe would repeat everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, like the Gemara says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer, Umoshe Omer v'kosev. And therefore, in Achanami, we didn't actually hear anochi Hashem elokach, like the Rambam says in Mar Nevuchim. It's not a stira. If so, why is it so fundamental to the basis of our belief? It's clear the Rambam held that the kol that we heard at Sinai, even if we didn't hear particular words, was such that did not leave any room for doubt. It was clearly the voice of God. While it's true we couldn't make out the specific words because we haven't reached the level, the madrega, that allowed us to understand prophecy, nevertheless, it's clear to us that this was God talking and communicating to Moshe, and that is indeed the basis of our belief. Okay, I think we're going to have to change the style of Chazara because it's going to go too slow. So what we're going to do instead is we'll go through the Chazara questions, and then if there are any subsequent questions, we'll do those. I do think that we'll cover most of the important things. So the truth is that we've certainly done the Chazar questions 1 and 2, which are the ones from this first section. So now let's turn to Chazar question number 3. Explain the Ravid's partial resolution for the seeming contradiction between free will and divine foreknowledge. The Ravid, and again you can follow along in the Makoros, the Ravid is indeed very difficult to understand. The Ravid, there are two ways to read the Ravid. One way to read the Ravid is that he is acknowledging that God's knowledge of the future is indeed somewhat not complete. Meaning to say, he's acknowledging that there does seem to be a contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. And he's saying that just like astrologers can look at the stars and figure out the future, but nevertheless, they won't definitively know the future, because while they could tell you what the mazel will say about the future, but a person has the power to overcome their mazel, so too HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he might know very, very likely what you're going to do in the future, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the power to choose freely, and accordingly, because we can choose freely, in a certain sense we can go out of our mazel, so it's possible that he wouldn't know. If that's the case, then the Ravid's answer is something similar to the Ralbag, not perhaps going as far, but similar to the Ralbag in the sense that he limits God's foreknowledge. Now, at least when the Ralbag says it, doesn't that present a problem? How could we limit God's foreknowledge? Doesn't that contradict divine omniscience? HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows everything. So the answer that we said about that point is that when we talk about God's, let's say, omnipotence, we mean to say that God could do anything that's conceivably possible. We don't mean to say that God could do something that's definitionally impossible. For example, God's existence is necessary, as we saw before. That means that God could not destroy himself. So is that a problem? There's something that God can't do? No, certainly not. As the Rambam says and the Rashba say, that something that's definitionally impossible is not a problem if you say that God can't do it, because that does not in any way imply a deficiency with respect to the Ribono Shel Olam. The fact that God cannot destroy himself does not imply deficiency. And thus, God could do anything that's theoretically possible, or that's conceivably possible, or that's definitionally possible. Therefore, if you actually assume that there is a contradiction between divine foreknowledge and free will, then to say that by God giving human beings free will, he's limited his foreknowledge is not a problem in and of itself. The notion that God limits himself to allow for our existence or our free will is also an idea that we see in other concepts. Question number 4. Explain the Rivash's resolution. So the Rivash seems to say that we're making a mistake when we assume that there's a contradiction. And the mistake is that we assume that just because something is true, that means that it's necessarily true. So if it's true that tomorrow I will eat eggs for breakfast, it's necessarily the case that I'm going to eat eggs for breakfast, such that it's inconceivable that I would eat anything besides eggs. I can't eat cereal. The Rivash says, no, that's not true. Ki ein laseish, Ve'ein yediyah zu machreches klal. God knows what we will choose freely to do tomorrow, and there's no contradiction. Just because it's true doesn't mean it's necessarily true. So what I'm going to do tomorrow could have been otherwise, and God knows what I'm going to choose, but because it's not necessarily true, it's conceivable to be otherwise, then that doesn't contradict the possibility of my choosing otherwise, and thus there's no contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. Number 5, explain Reb Tzadok's resolution. Reb Tzadok is indeed very difficult. He seems to be acknowledging that both are true. Now, most of the thinkers acknowledge both are true. And he writes that the idea is the following. When a person sins and he realizes that the sin itself is Ratzon Hashem, that is what the Gemara refers to as tshuva me'ava, whereas donos naso zchuyos. What does that mean? So what it l'chora means to say is that, in Shir we compared it to the Nefesh HaChaim's understanding of Ein Od Milvado Afilu L'Kshafim. What does that mean? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Teva. Rules of Teva, Kadosh Baruch Hu, above those rules, created supernatural rules, which allow for Kishuf. A person who realizes Ein Od Milvado will not be subject to the forces of Kishuf, because Ein Od Milvado means really there's nothing else besides HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is responsible for everything, all existence, and everything depends on his willing it to exist. Likewise, if something happens in the world, by definition, it's Ratzon Hashem, because nothing could happen that isn't Ratzon Hashem. If a person does tshuva to the point that he believes that everything is Ratzon Hashem, then almost everything, or everything else ceases to exist on a certain plane. Nothing exists that isn't Ratzon Hashem. And therefore, the Avera that he did is Ratzon Hashem. If a person realizes that, then the Avera itself is a Zchus. The whole system collapses. Now, obviously, Ratzadok points out that that is a difficult madrega to achieve because, for example, if a person really thinks everything, even in Avera, is Ratzon Hashem, then he would never do that Avera because he believes that there's only Ratzon Hashem. So when a person sins, he doesn't have that awareness. If he does total tshuva to the point that he thinks that everything is Ratzon Hashem, then yes, he'll recognize that even the Avera is a Ratzon Hashem, and therefore his Avera will turn into a Zchus. And therefore, the Reb Tzadok says, this is why the Avodah Yom Kippur is the Sir La'Azazel, because the Sir La'Azazel is, in a certain sense, a karban being offered to Avodah Zarah. Ordinarily, that's the worst thing, but when it's a mitzvah, so it's a mitzvah. Likewise, the Avera is also Ratzon Hashem, just like the karban to the Azazel, to the Avodah Zarah, is also Ratzon Hashem when there's a tzivur. Number 6. Does Rashi and Sota imply there's no foreknowledge with respect to matters pertaining to free will? Present the views of the Rama, Rav Elazar Meir Horowitz, and the Marshal. The Gemara in Sota says the following. It says there's a stira. On the one hand, a person gets a shidduch based on what they deserve. On the other hand, the Gemara says, "Hakol bidei shamayim." Arbaim yom kodem yitzir savlad, bas kol omers bas ploni laploni. Now this is a stira. Why? Because if 40 days before yitzir savlad, we already know the shidduch, and shidduchim are dependent upon zchuyo, so that means 40 days kodem yitzir savlad, it's already known whether the person's going to be a tzaddik or a rasha, and that's inconceivable because ein bidei ein, the way Rashi understands the Gemara, hakol bidei shemayim chutz mi'ir shemayim. Hakol bidei shemayim chutz mi'ir shemayim means a person has bechira about yir shemayim. A person has bechira whether he's going to be a tzaddik or a rasha. In which case, it couldn't possibly be stated arbaim yom kodem yitzir savlad whether he's going to be a tzaddik or a rasha. So hence, there's a stira between the statement that Shidduchim are dependent upon Zchuyos, and the statement that Hakol bidei shemayim chutz mi'ir shemayim, or that Arbaim yom kodem yitzir savlad, the bas kol announces bas ploni laploni. That's what the way Rashi explains the Gemara. So Rav Elazar Meir Horowitz points out, you see from here, that Rashi presumes that there's a contradiction between divine foreknowledge and free will. And the answer that Rashi is assuming is like the Ralbag, that God does not know the future. God does not know the choices that a person is going to make in the future. And hence, God does not know, Arbaim yom kodem yitzir savlad, whether a person will be a tzaddik or a rasha, like the Ralbag says. That's the way Rashi sounds like at first, and that's the way Rav Elazar Meir Horowitz understands the Gemara. The Marshal gives a very beautiful answer that no, Rashi does not necessarily hold of Ralbag. He could take the mainstream view that there is no contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. How is that possible? Because even if it's true, let's assume like the Rambam. The Rambam says there's no contradiction between foreknowledge and free will because while on the level of human knowledge, there is indeed a contradiction. If a human knows something in the future, that something's going to happen tomorrow, then indeed it's inconceivable that it won't happen tomorrow. But with respect to God's knowledge, that's not the case. God's knowledge is different than our knowledge. Our knowledge is separate from us. God's knowledge is not separate from him. And therefore, with respect to God's knowledge, there is no contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. Now, if that's the case, so then that's only true as long as it's only God's knowledge. However, if God is to communicate to a human being that in the future something is going to happen, then it's inconceivable that it won't happen. Because now it's no longer just God's knowledge, it's human knowledge. And with respect to human foreknowledge, there is a contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. Now, since in this case it's human knowledge, or at least conceivably human knowledge, because it says, bas kol machrezes velmeres, it's not just that God knows whether the person is going to, who he's going to marry in the future, but it's actually announced, it's a bas kol, so then there is a contradiction between foreknowledge and free will, because it's not divine foreknowledge, it's human foreknowledge, and if we assume like the Rambam, there is a contradiction between human foreknowledge and free will. Hence, there's no indication that Rashi holds like Ralbag. And this brings us to question number 7. The Ur Sameach uses this same Yesod to answer up the Lechem Mishnah's Kasha between the Rambam and Parak Hei of Hilchos Tshuva and Parak Vav. In Parak Hei of Hilchos Tshuva, we saw the Rambam said that there's no contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. Yet in Parak Vav, he asked, how could the Egyptians be punished if, after all, God stated, Vavadum v'inu osam? In other words, the Lechem Mishnah says he could have just answered that there's no contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. Just because God knew in advance that the Egyptians would persecute the Jewish people doesn't mean that they can't be punished for it. They had free will, and there's also foreknowledge. And therefore, the Lechem Mishnah says, you're right, we could have given that answer, but we give a different answer. The answer that the Rambam actually gives is each a particular Egyptian could have chosen whether or not to persecute the Jewish people. But the Ur Sameach says no, it's not true. Since Va'avadum v'inu osam was told to a Navi, namely Avram Avinu, so therefore it was no longer divine knowledge, it was human knowledge because it was told to a prophet, and thus there's indeed a contradiction between foreknowledge and free will, because it's again not divine foreknowledge but human foreknowledge. Number 8, how does Rambam reconcile the Talmud statement HaKol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Mir Shemayim with free will? The Rambam understands that HaKol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Mir Shemayim really just means that everything that's in the realm of free will is not Bidei Shemayim. It's not Yir Shemayim in the narrow sense, but in the broader sense, anything that's subject to the matter of free will. Pal Gemayim Lev Melech Biad Hashem Al Kosher Yachfotz Yatenu. What does this mean? The idea that God seems to direct the decisions of kings, meaning to say the implication is that kings don't have free will, God makes their decisions. Why is it true? Two explanations. Either, like Ralbag and Rabbeinu Yonah say, because since the decisions of kings are so important, they affect so many thousands of lives, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it would be reckless almost for God to leave their decisions to their whims. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to, at least at times, control the decisions of a king, because after all, those decisions affect so many different people. How does it relate to the hardening of Paro's heart? The second explanation based on the Ramchal is that if we presume direction in history, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants history to reach a certain goal, there's a purpose, let's say Gilui Kvod Malchuso, and the events through history unfold to ultimately lead to that end, then yes, there are times when major decisions, and especially those are decisions made by kings, have to be directed or subverted in order to lead to the broader goal. Okay, and how does that relate to the hardening of Paro's heart? One explanation for hardening of Paro's heart is precisely that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like the Pasuk says, Ani echbadati es libo veslev avadav leman shisios osayela bekirbo. What was the purpose of the hardening of Paro's heart? To show these nisim, right? To show these nisim, which, and as we talked about in class, the nisim, at least the first nine of the ten Aseres Adibros, Aseres Makos, relate to the important yesodos of Emunah, Leman Tedun Ki Ani Hashem, that God's existence, Leman Tedun Ki Ani Hashem Bekarav Haaretz, that God is God of the land, not just God of heavens, and Leman Tedun Ki Ein Kamoni Bekarav Haaretz, Achdus Hashem, there is no other power besides God. Now, that being the case, in order for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to achieve that teleological end, that purpose, that direction, to show the world clearly and definitively God's existence and his relationship to the world, then indeed he had to harden Paro's heart in order to achieve that goal. Okay. Number 10, did Paro lose his free will? Three explanations. So the first is that of the Rambam, that yes, there are times that a person can sin so egregiously they lose their free will. The second is that of the Ramban, who says no, Paro did not lose his free will. His free will was indeed maintained. The pasuk says that Hashem was mechazek a slave Paro. He gave strength to Paro's heart. What does that mean? Lechazek at libo. It means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Paro the strength to do what he freely chose. What did he want to do? He wanted to keep the Jews as slaves, as was clear from the first five makos, where before God hardened his heart. Ultimately, he was being coerced. The force of the plagues was too much to bear. He could no longer withstand the pressure of the makos, and was going to relent and allow the Jewish people to leave, not because that's what he wanted to do. That would not have been a free decision. It would have been something which he was coerced into doing. And thus God gave him the strength to do what he freely chose or freely wanted to do. So no, he didn't lose free will. On the contrary, the strengthening of Paro's heart allowed him to maintain free will. Another explanation given by Rasag and the Ikrim is that God does not even intervene in a person's motivations with respect to decision-making, as Ramban allows. The Makos, the decision to allow the Jewish people to leave, was entirely free. What does it mean that God hardened his heart? It meant that he delivered the Makos in such a way so as to preserve Paro's freedom. That's why there were breaks between Makos, such that during the Makos, Paro said, yes, yes, you could go. And then when the pressure went away, Paro changed his mind. He said, no, no, stay. And then once again that would happen, and once again he would change his mind. Number 10. Number 11. Sorry? He holds that, again, God does not only does he reject the Rambam that a person will sometimes lose free will, not only, but he even rejects Ramban. Ramban says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will sometimes tamper with a person's decision-making process. No, HaKadosh Baruch Hu won't even do that. He won't even, as it were, strengthen your heart to give you the strength. Rather, Hashem did not touch Paro's decision-making process at all, in direct sense. What did he do? He delivered the Makos in such a way that Paro would be able to say, no, the Jewish people can't go. And how was that done? That was done by allowing, by there being large gaps of time between the Makos, such that even when Paro said during the Makos you could go, he would change his mind during the respite and say, no, you must stay. Number 11, according to Rav Huttner, why is a person punished for a sin he had no choice but to commit? So first of all, we talked about here that it's indeed a chiddush, that there is such a concept of a sin that a person has no choice but to commit. Pashup shot is that this is against the Rambam. The Rambam says everybody is free entirely in all their actions. Now, while the Rambam clearly does concede, for example, in Hilchos Deos, that a person has a certain predilection. One person might have a predilection to get angry, another person might have a predilection towards physical desires, but in the end of the day, a person seems to have total freedom. Rav Huttner, as well as other thinkers, acknowledge, no, there are times that a person has no choice but to sin. So then why would a person be punished, as is implied by the psukim? And the answer, he says, is because you have to do tshuva anyway, because you could never know for sure whether a particular sin is a sin that you had no choice but to commit. And if you didn't do tshuva, that would show a lack of recognition that the sin is something very bad. And therefore, since you can never know with certainty that you had no choice but to commit a sin, and therefore you have to do tshuva. If you didn't do tshuva, that itself is a sin for which a person should be punished. Number 12. How do you reconcile Ramban's statement regarding the purpose of... Okay, here we're on the third unit. Ramban's statement regarding the purpose of mitzvos with his statement about the Mishkan. So, here we had two statements of Ramban. On the one hand, Ramban said that the purpose of mitzvos is certainly for us, as the Pasuk says, L'tov Lach, as the Pasuk says in Sefer Iyov, that, and is, I guess, obvious, Misvara, that a person cannot harm God, right? The Pasuk says, So, therefore, what is the purpose of mitzvot? The purpose of mitzvot is for us, for our sake, to make us better people, etc. Yet, when it comes to the building of the Mishkan, the Ramban says, don't think, at least at the Sod HaDavar, is that the building of the Mishkan is not just Tzarech Hedyot, for our purpose, but it's Tzarech Gavoa. And we saw it's not just the Ramban, but this is an idea that's seen in many sources. So, the way we resolve this, bekitzer, is by noting that, based on the Ramchal as well as earlier sources, that the purpose of the creation of the world from one perspective. Now, just to note, if you look at different makoros, you'll see different purposes ascribed to God with respect to the creation of the world. Some, like the Ramchal, stressed that it was lehetiv. Others, for example, you see in Ramban that it was lechvodo and the like. Now is not the time to get into this, but it's not a stira. They present different perspectives, as we'll explain presently. And moreover, it's important to remember that in the ultimate sense, or in the true sense, this isn't a question that we could possibly know the answer, because we could only relate to God insofar as he relates to us. Meaning to say, post-creation. Like the Mishnah Chagiga says, you're not allowed to ask what was before the creation of the universe. We can't relate to God in that sense. But insofar as what we could relate to, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu must have created the world in order to be meitiv, because he was chaser nothing. Nevertheless, the ultimate way to be meitiv is to create a system of schar va'onesh, because otherwise, for a person to get a gift that they don't deserve, so there's a shame involved in it, there's nama dekizufa, would not be the ultimate gift. So he set up a system of schar va'onesh. And in that system, we are able to have the perception that we're giving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that indeed there is something that we're giving him. Mashalama Dever Dome. So the other week, my wife asked our kids to set the table. Now, on Erev Shabbos. And she said, if you set the table nicely, I'll give you a jelly bean. So the kids went ahead and they set the table. Now, after the kids set the table, you have to set the table again. One person gets four knives, another person gets three forks, one person gets no knives and only spoons, right? It's a lot more work to reset the table than it is to set the table from scratch. So why does my wife ask the kids to set the table? For them, because it's for their benefit to learn how to help, to learn how to contribute, help them have a chelek in Hachanos of Shabbos. It's to teach them. And therefore, after they set the table, she gave them a jelly bean. So now what happened? So they felt they gave something to my wife. And therefore, my wife gave them a jelly bean in return. Whereas, in reality, they gave nothing to my wife because she had to reset the table after they were finished. And the jelly bean was purely a matana. So too, klapei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lahavdil. From our perspective, so From HaKadosh Baruch Hu's perspective, the mitzvos don't do anything to him. Im tadakta matitein lo, omam yadcha yikach. He's chaser nothing. However, from our perspective, we've set the table. We've given something to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We've given him nachas, because he set up the universe in such a way in which we are given the opportunity to give to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And thus, the jelly bean that we get, from our perspective, is something we deserve because we gave something to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though we know, and in a much truer sense, we gave nothing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Im chatasa matif albo, and everything is only letov lach. And thus, both statements can be true, though from different perspectives. Okay, that was question 12, right? Question 13. According to the Rambam in Sanhedrin, why is a gambler an invalid as a halachic witness? Everybody's purpose in the world should be towards one of two ends, towards making the world a better place, tikkun olam, or to making themselves a better person, self-perfection through Torah and Chachma and the like. When a person chooses a profession like gambling, they are doing nothing to make the world a better place. It doesn't contribute in any way to the world. It certainly doesn't make them a better person. And thus, that's what the Gemara means, Mishnah means, when it says, Eino b'yeshuvo shel olam. And such a person is a puzzle gambler. And this relates to the Rambam's general theory about the purpose of Torah and mitzvahs. The purpose of mitzvahs for the Rambam is twofold. One is to perfect society, and two is to perfect the individual through Chachma. 14. What are some of the critiques made by Maharal in Tiferes Yisrael against the philosophical worldview? So a number of critiques. Number one is that he thinks that the basis of the philosophical worldview of placing the intellect on such a pedestal is because of the fact that they see anything physical as negative, and therefore they deny it. And he shows how this is against the Torah. The Torah believes that a person could be Mekadesh Lechol. Second of all, or finally, there are others, but this is a perspective which is only limited to very few people. Certain great philosophers perhaps could relate to God in such a way as described by the philosophers, but the Torah is given to everybody. And that means everybody could achieve Shleimus through Torah mitzvos, which means, by definition, that it can't be just totally an intellectual and a philosophical pursuit. Number 15. Using your own words, some of the reasons, it's not a sentence, that the Rav offers for Chovos HaGuf. So the Rambam, offers a number of points. First of all, he critiques the Christian worldview, and this is a perspective that is the Rav attributes to Paul, but really throughout our history, many people have made this critique, whether it's philosophers in the Middle Ages or, you know, Reformed Jews in the 19th century, or Buber in the 20th century. The idea that Chovos Evarim don't make much sense. Really, we should just have love of God and love of people alike. And the Rav says that with such broad principles, such as love people, love God, those types of ideas are easily abused, and a person could justify virtually anything based on those things. And the Rav gave the example of the Holocaust, but the truth is all the persecution of Christians throughout history, all in the name of religion, show how when you have a religion without specific precepts, without a Shulchan Aruch, without mitzvos, just with broad, nice, general principles like love your neighbor and love your God. So that is subject to abuse. It could be distorted. Anything could be justified because there's no Shulchan Aruch, there's no laws. And what the Torah is, which is different than that, is that there is a Shulchan Aruch, there are halachos. It's true, a person could obviously distort halachos as well, but certainly not to the same degree, because it says you can do this, and you can't do this, and you can't do this, and you can't do this. And therefore, it's much less subject to abuse. Another point that the Rav stresses is that this helps a person. A person is by definition, always feeling closer and further from God. And one day a person might feel close to God. And such a day, he'll want to daven, and he'll want to be a tzaddik. And the next day, he'll feel spiritually blah, and he'll feel no cheshek to do mitzvos or be close to God. Now, if there's no Shulchan Aruch, if there are no mitzvos, if there are no specific things that a person has to do, then they won't connect to God on those days that they feel blah. And ultimately, they'll be much further from God. Judaism is much more realistic in the sense that it recognizes that human beings are not consistent in their emotions and in their closeness to God, and gives them a system of religion which allows them to remain Ovdei Hashem, even if perhaps they don't feel that same level of inspiration. Contrast the position of Rashi and Ramban regarding the definition of a chok. Ramban says that a chok is something, is a mitzvah that certainly has a reason, but we don't know the reason. Not 100% clear that Rashi disagrees with this, but there are some places where it sounds like a chok is a mitzvah without a reason. The purpose is that we follow, we have obedience and follow God's will. Number 17, in light of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, why do so many Rishonim offer reasons for mitzvos? The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that the Torah doesn't give the reasons for mitzvos because when it came to two mitzvos, the Torah did give the reason, namely, lo yarbilo nashim for a melech, and lo yarbilo susim, and Shlomo HaMelech said these reasons don't apply to me, and indeed he was nechshal. He said they won't cause my heart to stray, and they caused his heart to stray. He said I won't go down to Egypt to get horses, and indeed he went down to Egypt to get horses. From that Gemara you might say that we shouldn't offer reasons for mitzvos at all. Why then did the Rishonim offer reasons for mitzvos? So to this we gave a number of answers. First and foremost, because generally speaking, tamei mitzvos, like the tamim given by the Sefer HaChinuch or the tamim given by the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, are not meant to determine the parameters of the law. They're ways in which we can understand, to a limited degree, the purpose of the mitzvah. But we know, first of all, that it's a guess, and second of all, that it's one dimension and the like, and therefore we would never dream of doing what Shlomo HaMelech did, which is to limit the mitzvos or to determine the parameters of the mitzvos based on the tamim that we give. Mashein Kain, what the Gemara is saying, is if the reasons were given in the Torah, then we might indeed have felt that it was legitimate to say, well, the reason doesn't apply to me, and that would have led to a bit of michshol, as was the case with respect to Shlomo HaMelech. Give an example of Tam al Pidrash. Tam al Pidrash, we mean mitzvos whose, the reasons for mitzvos that don't affect the parameters. So an example we gave was the Gemara Nida that says that why was it that the Torah prohibited a Nida Labaila so that there'll be invigoration in marriage, that it won't be stale, because a woman won't always, a person's wife won't always be mutaris labaila, so that when she does become mutaris again, the relationship will be fresh and exciting. Nobody would have an ahavamina l'chora that that reason would affect the parameters of the law. For example, if somebody, Lamasha, went away on a trip for 3 months and came back and his wife was anida, nobody would have a havamina that, even though the reason isn't shaykh in that case, that the halacha isn't shaykh in that case. Somebody pointed out to me, the Taras HaShlamim does actually say that according to Rabbi Shimon and Reb Meir, who are Darish Taima Dekra, that would be the case. And therefore, they hold, according to Rabbi Shimon, this is a big chiddush, according to Rabbi Shimon, there's no iser nida for a penuya, because the reason doesn't apply. The reason's only shaykh for an eshes ish. Now, that's a very, very big chiddush. Pashtus is not that way. But if you do say that way, that's a gevaldik araya to the yisod that we're going to say in a minute from the Tosfos HaRash, that the ikar chiddush of Rabbi Shimon is that we're dorish taima dekra, even to the point that it's keneged pashtei dekra. Number 19. According to Nefesh HaChaim, why does Yaakov marry his two sisters while Chizkiyahu HaMelech is punished for not having children? Nefesh HaChaim says that the Avos, though, kept the Torah, as Chazal say. Why did they keep the Torah? Because they saw the benefit of keeping the Torah. They knew the Tamei HaMitzvos, and for the Nefesh HaChaim, that means the Tikkunim and the Olamos HaYonim. But however you explain the Tamei HaMitzvos, they saw that there are tremendous benefits to doing mitzvos, and therefore they kept the mitzvos. However, sometimes they realized that there are times when the Tamei HaMitzvos don't apply. For example, Yaakov saw that there would be greater Tikkunim if he married two sisters. And therefore, since the Torah was not yet given, you have the option of saying that since the reason doesn't apply, or it's, then I don't have to do the mitzvah. Ma she'en ken la'achar matan Torah. So then a person doesn't have that option. A person has to do the mitzvah whether or not the tikkunim, whether or not the reason applies. And therefore, even though Chizkiyahu saw that very bad things would come out of his having a child, as indeed was the case, his child was Menashe, and Menashe caused terrible, terrible, terrible destruction, but a person post-Matan Torah can't do what Yaakov did and say, I see that keeping the Torah is going to lead to all sorts of bad things. No. Post-Matan Torah, you have to fulfill the mitzvos. The Nefesh HaChaim actually says that's because we never are absolutely certain what the reason for mitzvah is, implying perhaps that if you did know, you would have the option of not doing the mitzvah, but we don't know for sure. Only Adam HaRishon Kodem HaChet knew the reason for all the mitzvos. However, you could explain that a little differently, based on the understanding of Rabbi Chanan, which is question number 20. And he points out that really, there are two components, two problems to every Avera. There's both the kilkel that comes out of the Avera, because after all, every Avera has a kilkel. If there's reasons for all the mitzvos, and reasons for all the Averos, then there's harm that's done by every single, caused by every single Avera. That's one component to every Avera. And the second is that any time you do an Avera, you're moreed against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, don't do it, and you did it. Now, even if theoretically a person were to know that in a certain case there wouldn't be a kilkel, like in the case of Yaakov marrying two wives or Chizkiyahu, but nevertheless there's still the merida, and therefore it's still aser. Masha'en kein, when the avos kept the Torah, kodem matan Torah, so there's only one component to every avera. There's only the kilkel. There wasn't merida because they were enen mitzuvin va'osin. If there is no kilkel, if there is no kilkel and there's also no merida, then of course it would be okay. Number 21, how does this relate to Rav Kook's justification of the Heter Mechira? So Rav Kook says, if that's the case, then if you know, based on Tamei HaMitzvos, that the reason for a particular mitzvah doesn't apply, so you still have to do it, like we said, based on Rav Ochanan. There's both the Kilkel and there's the Merida. You have to keep the Torah because God said so, besides the fact that there's also a tikkun in doing the mitzvos and a kilkel in doing every avera. And therefore, even if there's no kilkel or no tikkun because the particular situation is such that the reason of the mitzvah doesn't apply anymore, you still have to do it because of the tzivoy. However, that leads to the following conclusion. If you can somehow come up with a situation, perhaps through a harama, through some type of halachic loophole, that the tzivoy doesn't apply, so, and also the reason doesn't apply, then it would be legitimate. And that's how Rav Kook explains all haramos. For example, let's take Brisbane. So the reason why the Torah said that there's Hashmatas Ksafim is to help poor people, to give them a new start every 7 years. A person may be saddled in debt, and they're never able to get out of it, and especially poor people. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped them out and said every 7 years your debts will be annulled. However, Rat Hillel Shenimnu Ha'am Milahalvo says that the purpose of the mitzvah was being undermined. On the contrary, the mitzvah was hurting the poor people instead of helping the poor people as it was supposed to. And therefore, Amad V'Hiskin Prisbo. Now, he couldn't just do away with the mitzvah just because the reason didn't apply anymore, because there's still the tzivoy. But once you could have a harama, Prisbo does not violate the technical letter of the law, because based in is gove the chov, and it doesn't violate the spirit of the law, because anyway, Nimnu Ha'an Milahalvo says that the spirit of the law wasn't being mekuyim anyhow. So therefore, harama is appropriate because it prevents the letter of the law from being broken and the spirit of the law from being broken. And as long as that's the case, it's okay. And Rav Kook felt the same thing was true, at least to a limited degree, with respect to the Hatter Mechira. And if that's the case, then we see another example of how Tamei HaMitzvos do have practical relevance. 22, according to the opinion that we are not Darshin on Tamei Dekra, how do you explain cases where the Gemara does seem to use the reason to define its parameters? Two answers. So one answer we gave based on the Tos HaRash is that everybody agrees we could be Darsh Tamei Dekra when it doesn't contradict Pashtei Dekra. For example, the Gemara Bava Metzia says that if a animal is sick, it's matrezes velcheles, it's some type of diarrhea or the like, and if it eats, it's going to be in pain. So then you're allowed to muzzle it. Why? Because the purpose of the prohibition against muzzling is for the benefit of the animal, such that in this case, where it harms the animal to be unmuzzled and helps the animal to be muzzled, you're allowed to muzzle it. Tos HaRash says, "I lo darshinan tamei dekra," and here we're using the reason to affect the parameters. And his answer is, here it doesn't contradict Pashtei Dekra. We ask, so therefore what we see then is when Rabbi Yehuda says lo darshinan tamei dekra, it's not a philosophical objection to being darsh tamei dekra, but it's a textual objection. We can't be darsh tamei dekra because it contradicts the text, the Pashtei Dekra. We asked, how is it, or why is it that in the case of taking collateral from an almana, that to apply that to a poor widow and not a rich widow doesn't contradict Pashtei Dekra, but in the case of not muzzling an animal, it does not contradict the Pashtei Dekra. And to this we answered that perhaps the pshat is that since the reason for the prohibition against muzzling an animal is so obvious that limiting it to a case where it helps the animal is not against the Pashtei Dekra. It's an obvious exception. Whereas when it comes to the prohibition against taking collateral from a widow, the reason is not obvious. In fact, there might even be a dispute about the reason. And therefore, to limit it does indeed contradict Pashtei Dekra. We noted that this answer may not help in all cases. And the other answer we gave was that we have to distinguish between the philosophical why and the juridical why. Meaning to say, sometimes when we ask why is this mitzvah given, or what is the reason for the mitzvah, we can ask it from a philosophical perspective. From an outside perspective, looking from the outside, what is the reason for the mitzvah? Or we could ask it from an internal perspective. What is the reason for the mitzvah? Meaning to say, what's the lamdas? How does it work? An example that we gave was the opinion in the Gemara that says that you're allowed to be poda a chamor, that's a bechor, with money, because the whole reason why the Torah said you could use a sheep is lahakel. So what's the Gemara doing? Seemingly it's saying, what's the reason for the mitzvah that you could use a sheep for pidyon petach chamor? And saying the reason is lahakel, al klal yisrael, terchas al mimonam. So it's asking why and then determining the parameters. But really, that type of why is not an external philosophical why, but an internal question. It's asking, what's the lamdas? Why is this different from all other cases of pidyon? Usually, in every other case of pidyon, you are poda with the money or with something shava, not with a sewa for a chamor. And since the motivation of the question is internal, so then it isn't time of dekra, it's really just good lamdas. 23. Give some examples of when we use the reason for a mitzvah to expand the mitzvah. We gave a number of examples of this. The mitzvah of Talmud Torah. The tzivoy is just v'limadetem es b'neichem, but the mitzvah, of course, is to learn Torah, not just as a hechsher of teaching. The mitzvah of tshuva, according to the Rambam. There's no mitzvah of tshuva, there's only mitzvah of vidui, but the reason, the tam of vidui is mechayev tshuva. For kibud avim, according to the Rashba, is understood by the Gra. We gave the example in also smaller mitzvos. For example, tzar bali chaim is aser min haTorah. How do you know that? Because the Torah says you have to unload the weight off of an animal. So we say, why did the Torah tell us to unload the weight from an animal? So as to prevent pain from the animal. So from that narrow formulation, the narrow tzivoy, we derive a broad formulation of tzar bali chaim aser deoraisa, that you can't cause any pain. In other words, we ask the reason for the mitzvah, why do you have to take the weight off the animal? Answer, so as not to cause pain to the animal. From there we derive a broad prohibition against causing pain to animal, not just the narrow case. Or in the case of bal tashchis, the Torah's narrow formulation is you can't cut down fruit trees in a time of war when you need wood, but that leads to a broader commandment against general wastefulness, because the very reason that you can't cut down fruit trees in a time of war tells us that you can't be destructive needlessly in general. Number 24, the Midrash states, V'chimach v'slakadosh baruch hu m'shochit min ha-tzava or shochit min ha-oref ha-ve-omer lo ninu ha-mitzvah sal-tzar v'sabrios. So how does Rambam understand this? How does Ramban understand this? Rambam understands this means to say that while all the mitzvos have reasons, there are certain mitzvos whose details may not have a reason. And the Ramban understands this to mean, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu command us in mitzvos? Does he benefit from the mitzvos? No, mitzvos are letzayifas abrios, to purify us, meaning to say to make us better. So, for example, in this case, from God's perspective, it doesn't matter whether you shecht from the front or the back, but for us it does make a difference, because if we were to shecht from the back, that's something cruel, and that would make us into cruel people. But since the Torah said slaughter from the front, so we'll learn to be caring people, considerate of other people's and even animals' pain, and not cruel. Finally, present Rambam's view on the reasons for karbanos. So first of all, we saw that the Rambam seems to say different things in different places. Sometimes he calls it a chok. Sometimes he says that the purpose is to prevent idolatry. Other times he gives reasons for some of the details. For example, he says that the reason why the Minchas Chote doesn't have Shemen and Lavona is to cause the person to do tshuva and reflect upon the gravity of sin. Other times he says that the purpose of karbanos has a reason, but the details don't have a reason, etc., etc. And we use this as an opportunity, A, to talk about how there are sometimes contradictions in the Mar Nevuchim, as the Rambam himself says there will be. One of the reasons the Rambam says there are contradictions is so as to make the Sefer obscure for those who shouldn't be studying it in the first place. After all, it's usher to teach Maaser Bereishis and Maaser Merkava publicly. Esoteric matters have to only be taught one-on-one, and even then only with somebody ra'ui and beremiza. But here in this case, you probably don't have to come on to that. There really isn't a contradiction, as we showed. And it's also true that we mentioned many of the resolutions that were given to the Rambam's position over the ages. Some, for example, are a mechalik between a bama, which was given only as a concession to the idolatrous inclinations of the time, and karbanos in the mikdash, which have a higher purpose, or perhaps the difference between karbanos nidarim and nidavos, which are meant as a concession to the idolatrous inclinations, because oftentimes they stand in the way of tshuva and tefillah, versus karbanos chova, which don't have that same fear, and the like. So that brings us to the final unit of Mashiach and Olam Haba. I didn't give you any review questions on that because I figured it's still very fresh in your mind, so we don't need a chazer. But if there are any questions about issues on that unit, let me take those first, or anything that you want me to chazer from that. Any questions in general, then? Okay, so we'll stop here. As I said, this isn't complete, but at the same time, you certainly don't have to have everything I said memorized. For the Bechina, you need general familiarity with the topics, and the ability to read the text, which admittedly are sometimes very difficult, but the Bechina itself is not something you have to worry too much about. It's not very hard, the purpose more generally is to bring an awareness to the topics and what some people say, and I think the breadth of the different perspectives. And so any further questions, I'd be happy to answer now or in general, before the Bechina, after the Bechina, and Hatzlacha Rabbah.